Before I introduce Dr. Baker, I have a few hundred announcements to make. Next Wednesday night, we'll have the first of our series of student readings in this auditorium. And three of the candidates for Masters of Fine Arts in Poetry will be reading: Tom Cox, Kim Mielecki, and Martha Ostheimer. And November 1st and 2nd, in cooperation with the Academy of American Poets and Arizona State University, we are co-sponsoring a Festival of Southwest Poets. And I have some flyers on that I put out on the refreshment table, so I hope you'll pick up a flyer. The first day of the festival, there'll be a panel discussion here with six poets. And that evening, three of the poets will read in this auditorium. The next evening, we'll all trek up to ASU, and the other three poets will read there. But the poets who are participating in the festival are N. Scott Mamaday, Naomi Shihab Nye, Peggy Shoemaker, Alberto Rios, Joy Harjo, and Richard Shelton. And as with everything, the Poetry Center sponsors the readings are free. And we have punch and cookies. A week from tonight, the Russian department is sponsoring a very special reading by Russian emigre Igor Chinov. And he will be reading in Harville Building, room 203, at 8 o'clock. Harville is that building that's kind of hard to find, you know. It's over there. You wander around in a maze for hours before you find where you're supposed to be. And don't go by yourself, because it's dark and strange over there. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Baker to our campus. I had read his vita and expected an elderly gentleman. I was quite surprised to be introduced to this nice young man. Houston Baker is the director of the Center for the Study of Black Literature and Culture at the University of Pennsylvania. He's published three collections of poetry: No Matter Where You Travel, You Still Be Black, Spirit Run, and Blues Journeys Home. He's written or edited 17 other books, including Black Literature in America, which is an anthology of Black American literature from folklore to the present, A Many-Colored Coat of Dreams, The Poetry of County Cullen, Modernism and the Harlem Renaissance, Afro-American Poetics, and most recently, Workings of the Spirit, A Poetics of Afro-American Women's Writings. His numerous honors include the 1986 Distinguished Writer of the Year Award from Middle Atlantic Writers Association and fellowships from the Rockefeller and Guggenheim Foundations. I hope you'll stay after the reading and have some refreshments and get acquainted with Dr. Baker.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. One of the reasons it's wonderful to be here is because I've not been here before, and so it's nice to go to new places. Another reason it's nice to go to be here is because I have a lot of friends here who have for years been in a semi-chamber of commerce capacity, saying if you've never been there, you've been nowhere. And after being picked up and shepherded around today, last night and today by Annette Kalodny and Dan Peters, and seeing Barbara Babcock and Kit Hensley and other people who have made the day very pleasant, and hearing a wonderful talk by my wife. You know, y'all missed the best of the team today earlier. I told her not to be so good because it would make it tough tonight. But it's been a wonderful day, and the weather's cooperated and so forth, and I'm glad you all came out tonight. In this capacity, in the capacity of poet, I never have felt comfortable, and I don't feel comfortable now. So you'll have to bear with me as I make my way into this. One of the reasons I don't feel comfortable is precisely because it seems to me that my fort. What I do best is probably literary criticism, and that poetry is a secondary process. Now, I had a person who agreed very much with me in this for a good deal of my apprenticeship as a poet. She is now my wife and has been for 28 years. I would pass on things to her and I would say, you see, here's my latest poem. And she would look at it and she would say, ontologically imbibing the late night rain. What is this? This is not a poem, right? And I would go from poet to poet in my literary classes and try to emulate them and write my own poems and put my own words in. And she'd keep handing them back to me. And at one point, after I had published a volume of poetry and gotten a little bit down the line, it seemed to me that summarizing a lot of experiences might be those words that she used to say to me, and that is, this is not a poem. So I wrote a poem called This Is Not a Poem, which is about a lot of things. Maybe it's about how all of us come to be poets, which I think probably everybody is. This is not a poem. This is not a poem, nor aesthetic experience. This is a story of my grandmother's hands chapped from white folks' wash, an account of her back spasmed from scrubbing floors. This is not a poem, nor icy art emotion. This is a narrative of my father's father scraping pennies from a rocky economy, depression, baby, devouring everything in sight. This is no poem, nor a subtle tingle down your spine while shaving. This is a tale of my mother rebuked for calling a black man gentleman. Lizzie, tell your daughter that black men are never gentlemen. This is no poem, nor am I blessed to be impersonal. I will make no attempt to distance you. Had you been there, any of you, while I was growing up, or even in the thin, worn time of their decline, I would have introduced you, allowed you to share the fine goodness of ancestral caring. So that's not a poem. When I began to think about what it was that constituted not only a poet, because if you walk around in the United States with melanin, unfortunately, you can't be a poet, right? You can only be what? Right, a black poet, right? So I thought, well, okay, you know, I got one hurdle here, you know, done, and right, this is not a poem. What is it that makes you a black poet? The most recent installment on that answer, or an answer to that question, is the blues. But there were earlier responses, and it seemed to me that the title of a first volume of poetry, No Matter Where You Travel, You Still Be Black, was at least a process of definition. And the signature poem for that volume, and probably in most gatherings that I go to is that, goes, no matter where you travel, you still be black. You carry all your history on your own damn back. Now, your mama raised you proper. Your daddy caused you pain. You understand Beethoven, but you still love the train. And I found out that Martha was from Carolina, and she was looking at the front of the volume here, table of contents, having embarrassingly asked me where one of the poems came from, which volume, and I had to look at the table of contents, and she said, my goodness, Carolina, Coltrane, and Love. I'm from Carolina. And I said, well, I'll read Carolina, Coltrane, and Love. So Carolina. North Carolina was a significant experience because I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and have been trying to outgrow that ever since, including language and dialect, because we called it Louisville, right, at that time. And I was told that I could not say literature when I went to Howard University. So I've been working on all these elisions and, you know, things that you do. But getting back to North Carolina for our research here at the Research Triangle Park was great because the flora, the fauna reminded me of Louisville or Louisville. And it helped the writing of Blues Journeys Home. So Carolina Coltrane in Love is a family poem. Gray autumn squirrel scoots across a distant branch. Sunlight slashes trees, revealing textures in Saturday light, rare as earth itself. In my living room, John Coltrane plays Neymar. The old gold and stubborn green of Carolina are flavored by a neighbor's smoke. There is a shaman on this album chanting, torturous, older than earth, as my son awakens with a boisterous yawn. A horn is invoking chaos, creating comfort, ordering old African spirits. Today, my son and I will complete his African project, working together at rituals ancient as the seasons old. Those chordal progressions of train blast barriers. The shaman gives birth to the world. The squirrel is on our deck, dry leaves and sheets of sound. We discuss, my son and I, forest and rivers older than the signs of man. On that disc, Neymar gives way to Om, a single hand clapping. Charlotte awakens, stretches toward the sun. She is motion, she is energy, embodiment of spirits called. The ending is black. The ending is love. The ending of African genius is always, always love. Carolina Coltrane and Love. Well, where to go? This is the title poem of second volume of poetry that's called Spirit Run. It's about running, which is really strange for a poem, right? To say Spirit Run and to be about running, because there's a standard poetical rap that you all have heard, right? That the poet does as a kind of entr'acte. And it goes, gee, I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I was visiting my mother out in Seattle. And in her backyard, there's this really interesting Japanese maple. And the deer come each year, you know. So this is a poem about my mother and the deer, right? And then they read something like, cosmology's bursting, the tone is rain. Yeah, and they go on. But this is really a poem about running, which I was fanatical about not so long ago, called Spirit Run. Stones in the path are no object. Darkening skies offer no retreat. And my legs stretch farther. Pace quickens as first rain begins to fall. The mind revives a moment long past. By a lake in a country of red, we sat, grandfather. You told of kin battered and sold. You mapped the land's holy spaces. You bestowed upon my boy's self blues notes of our survival. I mount the final hill, reflecting that the land's now contour holds no record, coded message, secret name. The blatant fact that we have run is signaled by these single shoe prints in the sun. Trees grow still. My slapping soles are the only sound for miles around. A moment of revision is at hand. Approaching the low grounds clearing, I remember the Karen tribesmen's chant, On this day of good sun and brilliant moon, we leave this for you to eat. Shadows of the spirit house descend. Imagination reigns. And as I cool into the blues of southern summer dusk, I dedicate this poem and present run to you. You who worked the levees, you who worked the long rice fields, you who taught us the graceful stride of this American race. You don't have to do that, you know, I mean. Annette says, I'm paying you honorarium. I can do anything I want. I'll clap when I want to. Someone wrote to me recently, just out of the blue, which is an unusual, at least for me, poetical experience, and said, I've read your poetry. It was great, wasn't it? So I thought, wow, okay, it's happening. But this one person who wrote to me also said that he liked poems in a section of Blues Journeys Home that are the section called Guardians. And again, last night as we sort of traveled on the plane into Tucson, I asked Charlotte which ones I should read from this. Here's one of my favorites. This is a poem for Gus Cannon, and it's not C-A-N-O-N, right? It's C-A-N-N-O-N, Gus Cannon, who was a reviser in his own right, though. And Gus Cannon was a blues man and played the guitar. And in the blues, there's a guy by the name of Barry Pierce who's written a book about this. There's a standard story. Musicians want to play their music, but their mothers and fathers say it's sacrilegious and they won't let them play it. They won't buy them instruments, and so they have to make their own first instrument, so they have an uncle somewhere who's not far away, and they steal his guitar, and their adventures like having to jump out the window and leave the guitar behind because they've been messing with somebody's wife, and you know, you get these stories of bluesmen, and Gus Cannon's story is not unlike that when he tells it about his early days and how he came to guitar playing. But he used to play in Memphis, and he had a group called the Jug Stompers, Gus Cannon's Jug Stompers. And I saw a picture once of Gus Cannon, and Gus was bad. I mean, he was definitely bad, the way he dressed and so forth. So he seemed to me to capture not only the standard story of the blues man, but also, in a sense, implied or suggested the lifestyle. So a poem for Gus Cannon. A raccoon skin scraped thin for resonance, a guitar neck and an old bread pan made you a stomper, medicine show traveler, jug band man for southern barbecues and rollicking barrel houses. Your long frame became an instrument of pure delight. Men in plantation fields held you in awe. Brown girls with big eyes hummed at your strumming, Gus. And around Memphis, everyone took pride in your new store-bought guitar and sharp-creased pants. Gus Cannon, you would say. Gus Cannon and his jug stompers here to let you know what country blues is all about. And then you made them, Gus, drop down, mama, sweet as the showers of rain. Gus, you bet. This is a person in another tradition, as guardian of the culture, as guardian of the lore, as guardian of the word. This is a poem for Hosea Hudson, H-O-S-E-A, Hudson, who is a black communist worker and will tell you that he is still a black communist worker. Gus was around during those days when the Communist Party in the United States endorsed a separate black nation, a nation within a nation, and suggested that people should organize among workers. And Hosea Hudson worked in the whole southern region when you had to do the kinds of things that you had to do again in the 1960s, and who knows, we might have to do again in the 1980s and the 1990s and in the 2010s and whatever. But he was eluding always one brigade of people threatening to beat up communist workers. And he was a person who read the literature and who was deeply, deeply invested and still is in the Communist Party and in its possibilities in the United States of America. And a friend of mine by the name of Nell Painter, N-E-L-L, and just like the word painter, who is a brilliant black woman historian now at Princeton, wrote a book called The Narrative of Hosea Hudson. And she afforded me the privilege one day of going with her over to Atlantic City, where Hosea Hudson lives, while she taped and interviewed and talked with him about the Communist Party and his work. And I wrote a poem about that day and about Hosea Hudson. For Hosea Hudson, black communist worker at age 79, the pungent odor of vapor rub and too many hours without sun, or the season's quick wind through broken screens, was your room. The compact chairs were bursting their limits, their stuffing exposed to bright, dim, gray ancestors across the walls. The browning of a bare bulb on the table, laden with political affairs. Refrigerator clicks, hums low in a farther room as a counterpoint, as low signifying voice without judgment in the tape recorder's whirring, and your voice. Not everyone can be in the party. Now, the party don't mind your having a friend, even a lady friend. But they didn't want you hopping around from limb to limb like no bantam rooster. The cassettes change, scene unfolds in mute significance, eyes along the wall, under table glass, on a mantel's ledge become family, and you resume. That's my mother. She is faint, unripe candidate for his dark voice. And the cousin I told you about, her daughter, an aunt, my mother's sister. He is drawn back by the sharp fight of dogs outside. Every afternoon, them dogs, but that weren't my point. My point, you see, is there ain't no such thing as high ups in the Communist Party. What you got is democratic centralism. The majority side, then everybody got to shut up. Dogs crackle through the room, releasing violent eyes along the wall, avoiding the frame of his dead wife in coffin. I inquire about the overall black man and his solemn black companion. Yes, show. That's Sarge Carfield, his brother-in-law, down in Baton Rouge before he lost his strength. The light dims and resumes. I'm old now, but I still believes. Hold it. I think now what I like to do is, before reading one other poem in this volume, or a couple of other poems in this volume, try some things that are recent and fairly new. They all have stories of one sort or another, but I haven't made them up yet, so kind of take it as it comes. This is a poem that's called After All That Happened. And I think, in a sense, this poem is a kind of break that moves away from Blues Journeys Home and offers an opening into a different kind of poetical world and different themes. After all that happened, you have come back to me through legends, rumors, wars of the self, analysis, tears and blood, the agony of operations incalculable, the severing of heads and tearing of flesh, the mightiness of your suffering is beyond question or doubt. When they pushed you farther than the mind could bear and you took residence outside your skin to behold their sick violence, I was bound hand and foot beneath ashes of despair. I heard your tears, but could not move. The sun the next morning rose as though nothing was wrong, but your blood was a screen across it. My eyes were the color of milk. You touched my forehead, but cringed when I reached for your face. You knew it was no longer there. And now you have come back to me through caverns of despair. You are not afraid of man monsters who walk midnight streets with their flags waving, killing women and children across the old city's moons. You have come back across deserts of loneliness and depressions set in stone. You are moving across gleaming mirrors, your image rejoined to solid flesh. Your mind is a flowering garden now, and I love you more than ever, and I love you more, more, more than ever before all that happened. We moved a few years ago to a place called Belfry, as in bats, as everybody would say. They'd say, "You live where?" And we'd say, "Belfry Drive." They'd say, "As in bats," right? You know, so you sort of would anticipate the line, right? Say, "I live in bats," as in Belfry, right? You know, to confuse them. But this is a place that had lots of Republicans who were nice to us. They left us alone. We called it benign neglect. And the compensation for this was that there were lots of geese and wonderful tree lines, and it was, at that point, the country. It stopped being the country as they built lots of houses, and now we've moved from there. But there's a set of poems that I kind of call the Belfry poems, and the first one is called Grandfather. The muscles in my grandfather's neck grew slack in his 90s, making channels through which the spirit flowed, black beds of wisdom where rivers rose. His sinews were cathedral columns lifting to radiant eyes, where I read the whole earth's love and pain. Today, winter geese at sunset recall those ancient outlets, suggest a black and gracious gift of sound. Belfry 2, Hiroshima Now. Afternoon, and our chimes of Parth, our wind chimes hang melodiously. They are counterpart for wrinkled veterans on television. They speak of a day 40 years ago when the gay Enola rained fire on the Orient. We see on the tube, despite the chime's distraction, surgically perfect faces, spotless children following old footage, and more white males talk of napping, napping, while fire set the ground boiling, babies dying, samurai melting. The wrinkled man says, "Well, I was so tired, to tell you the truth. After the mission, I went back into the back of the plane and slept for hours. Never occurred to me what a great thing we had done." Belfry's sun makes late clouds lavender and rose. Bells of nearby churches peal like charred flesh dropping to earth. I push open the screen and assault our chimes apart with a madness that makes my neighbors stare. I guess this would have to be Belfry 3, wouldn't it? I mean, logically, it would follow. It would be cool if it was Belfry 6, right? And everybody would say, what happened to the missing Belfry poems, right? A whole dissertation of speculation. This is 3. This is from my son, Mark Frederick Baker, who is now a freshman in college. It's called Against Romance. He might be a little embarrassed by this poem now. This was written when he was a junior in high school, and he quite liked it then. But it's called Against Romance. Behind the line of trees at Belfry, light rises. Birds who should be romantic, grackles, swifts, but are only sparrows, dart into the sunrise like thrown objects, foot da. My son, who should resemble romantic heroes, but is more beautiful, has departed for the day. The house grows hugely, and I, who should know more prestigious things to do, have already begun planning his return. He will arrive in the red orange of evening, a light that silhouettes barrenness and raises plain birds to winter perches. He will not realize how exciting my day has been without him. Oh, Tom Dent. This is a poem that I've not read before. It's for a woman by the name of Rita Watkins. She was the first wife of a mentor of mine in college. And she and the mentor were both extraordinarily important to us. The poem is called Simply for Rita, R-I-T-A. It seems now always the same, morning and wind, the leaves down and endlessly moving, pools undercover, boats moored, deck chairs firmly stored. It seems now always to last, the strangely full feeling of having consumed too much, of having eaten more than a fill and unable to bear the radiant weight of the hearth's glow. It is as though with winter nothing can be renewed, the destroying hand of December lifting heat and life and all nourishment from the surface, an icy destruction that pushes away grave covers on summer grills, rattles the new panes in every room. It seems now to have swallowed the good, to have scuttled and sunk the last dry enterprise of August. Today, word came of the same bleak endings. I see you on a barren farm in Idaho, sorting out what is left of your life, the piles of books and letters for designated friends and places, the unguents and perfumes arranged in serried rows along your dresser, a gentle hand passing along a kitchen shelf. Then you read once more a son's card sent long ago. Write what they shall read of you upon that wintry discovery. You ignite the engine, stuff the largest means of breath, await in December the same, always the same, quiet hope of death. But it's not always the same, is it, really? Nelson Mandela had a birthday, and people put together a collection of poems for Nelson Mandela's birthday to be sent off to hopefully to him, but certainly to South Africa. And this is called A Birthday in the Dust for Mandela in his 70s. The dust and great trees mark the contrast. Brown sediment settles over ripe savannas. Lush growth bounds its space. Dust is an itinerant reminder of soil possessed, people dispossessed. Its element is wind, rustling trees, carrying fine grains everywhere. Forests of Johannesburg are a rich burgeoning of stone and steel. White settlers are lush, reducing black and brown life to the invisible wind, riding out of Bantu stands and urban bistros. Wind blows majestic clouds like prophecies of change. Speckles are what you catch, Nelson Mandela, in the sunlit stream of your cell, a swirl of brown and black that reminds you of the day the earth was born, cosmic matter that will not abate. You are a grain no bounded moment can contain, no great and settled trees resist. This is a poem about my father and an experience in youth. It has trees in it, but they're not maples, and they're no deers. On a cold Saturday, full of gray sidewalks and first steps of real youth, I was no more than four. My young dad promised a nickel for each piece of firewood that made it to the backyard in my arms. Suddenly, the elm was gone. I went bravely loaded under wood, feeling rich already when pieces began to fall. The dime I made is luscious today. At your death, I thought of the oxen yoke and lacquered wood you urged upon us always. The elm was suddenly no more. The shining coins of memory you bestowed, the example you were that fall day when your bulging arms lifted me toward a gray sky like a very tree of glory. This is a poem that Annette will appreciate, since we kind of started out in New Haven together. I don't think this is a very deep poem, but there's something sardonic about it. I couldn't even tell you, I think, anyway. I hope there is something sardonic about it. It's very short. It's called Girl at the Bar, after Manet. A white arm, blue-veined, and draped across a table. Sundays in New Haven are like that. That's it. A more romantic poem in place, it's called Sighting, C-I-T-I-N-G, Eric the Red, who found Greenland. We were flying back from, from Nigeria and then from London to the United States, and we crossed over this huge, amazing sight, right? And the pilot came on and he said, this was the first real estate hustle, right? The guy named it Greenland, right? and told people they could come and live the good life there. So this is called Sighting Eric the Red, Who Found Greenland. Right? When I'm finally finished, I want Fulani maidens to reduce my bones to ash and deposit them on caps and peaks of Greenland. At last I will live in the shadow of glacial valleys with Eric the Red. We will invent melodies for ice flows and harmonies for singing whales. Earth, wind, and fire will keep us going forever. And a couple of the most recent poems, and then I think I'll read one last one from the other volume. This is called Me and William Carlos. Enough said, as my son says to me sometime, right? A violet-tinged pink softly takes place behind belfry trees. I am writing poems today only about what one can see. Imagination need not apply. Brown sticks, black birds, a fallen fence around the garden where someone's Sunday paper has been redistributed by a socialist wind. A place where a red wheelbarrow might stand if only it would rain. This is called Mountain Radio in Winter. This is the Poconos. The curve and spread of these hills was as surprising as the divertimento or your telephone call from a suburban town. Voice and music spreading like light in winter places. Yo-Yo Ma's with the stringed grace of December love. This is my William Carlos Williams poem. If this does not remind you of William Carlos Williams, I don't want to know about it, okay? All right? Don't tell me, all right? It's called A Blessing of Horses. A touch in January of spring brings chestnut horses to the field, dry as sedge. One stretches for water, creates a sculpture at rest with water and the startling grace of winter earth. Okay. From Blues Journeys Home. This is a poem for my wife. We had a dinner party once, and we had a very nice Chablis or something. And then we had people who said, do you have any more of that Chablis? And we did. And we opened some more of the Chablis. And suddenly everybody was just turned toward the spot where my wife was sitting because she was talking about her past and things that I knew nothing about. Or, of course... would never have married her. but actually, she was talking about her youth. She used to go down to North Carolina in the summer, which was a familiar practice. Northern families who had migrated black would send the kids back south to be with grandparents. But I hadn't heard these stories. So this is called Socializing Roots, or When My Wife Surprised the Dinner Party with Talk of Her Youth. I see you in North Carolina dawns, your knees rattling against the morning chill, yellow pump water in your 6 years' hands. Your city-born mom has launched you south with toothpaste, toilet tissue, warning off dirt and the country. You return from the field with foaming mouth, the butt of rural jokes with flattened toilet rolls in your possession. No Sears catalog for your tender bottom. Undaunted, you meet the sun with your own etchings in dust, shell-dried corn for your grandfather's biddies, tough birds all. Your words return, southern accents, sources of your excellence, hidden until now. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Dr. Baker. Dr. Baker will be lecturing tomorrow afternoon in this building, room 410 at 3 o'clock. And I understand you've changed the lecture topic. What's the...
It's about rap music.
About rap music.
About rap music.
Great. That's at 3 o'clock tomorrow in 410. Won't you join us for some refreshments?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
What a nice one.
Oh, yeah, we are.
What?
We have. This is two in a row,
true.
We had one last night.
Wow,
that's
fantastic.
Thank you. I'm Bob Houston. I teach fiction.
Hi, how are you?
Very pleased.
I understand that we were conflated last night.
We were conflated?
Yeah. Robert Houston, and then she said, Houston will read, and that we...
I'm right together
with a real writer. I felt
proud.
My
first wife's last name was Baker. When we got married, she was Sharon Houston Baker.
Is that right?
Oh, my God, it's the whole family. So do you ever get back to Louisville?
I have been back within the last couple of years.
Do you know anybody? Bellarmine?
No, but I used to know people at Bellarmine. I mean, Bellarmine was, of course, the school of choice when I was growing up.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, a couple of people came to me and said, you know, why are you leaving Louisville? I mean, right here you have Bellarmine College and you should go to, you know. No. Yeah, I was...
I read there. I spent a week in residence there and was really impressed.
Catholic, yes.
It's Catholic, and it is where Thomas Merton's papers are.
Exactly.
You know, it's connected with that kind of...
Kind of major reputation.
Yeah.
I mean, with U of L and the school in the Louisville. But I mean, it was right. You know, a lot of people. Yes,
you are really good, by the way.
Oh, listen, thank you, thank
you.
That's really
forget
nice
being
you.
A critic.
Okay,
that's not worth it.
Thanks. It's always tough, though. I really the process is getting easier of writing, and I'm liking it more. But to get up and do it is still really tough. And there were poems that I knew I was going to read tonight. I mean, because I've got a whole thing about the muse and their loved ones, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, that'll be the principal thing to read tonight, you know? And I couldn't do it.
I couldn't do it. But you're one of my closest friends, a guy named Paul Mariani, who did the William Carlos Williams book.
Okay.
And for years, we've been talking about it. And Paul said, should I stay with the scholarship? Should I write poetry?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the same thing I told Paul. Right point.
Oh, God.
Because you're so good at it.
Thank you.
You're so
Thank
good
you.
At it.
That's lovely.
Glad to hear you mention Hosea Hudson. That was he and my grandfather were friends years ago.
Were they?
Yeah,
no
my
kidding?
Grandfather was an old Wobbly and CIO organizer in the South.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Hosea, and there aren't many people that know him. I always, Hosea he calls it?
Yeah, Hosea.
Okay.
He calls himself Hosea.
Hosea.
Yeah, because you think Hosea, you know, or any other kind of pronunciation you could come up. But Hosea Hudson is what he calls
Oh, I love that.
Tough
name.
Man. Tough
Wouldn't you
man.
Love to have a name like
I would
that?
Love to have a name like that.
It's so wonderful.
That's right. Hi, I'm Hosea Hudson.
Yeah, I'm able to say
right.
that.
Yeah.